You are listening to Right on Radio on KFAI 90.3 FM and streaming live on the web at KFAI.org. I'm Josh Weber, and tonight on Right on Radio, we are featuring an hour-long interview from a special guest host, Roderick Phipps Kettlewell. Trained at the Juilliard School, Kettlewell has enjoyed a successful career based in a wide variety of professional musical activities. He has performed and recorded as a piano soloist, as an accompanist, a chamber musician, and has conducted extensively in the choral, opera, and orchestral genres. These credentials make him more than qualified for interviewing Daniel E. Freeman, the author of Mozart in Prague.
And I'm Dave Fettig, here to tell you a little bit about that book. Dismissed in Vienna as a composer of excessively complicated music with little popular appeal, Mozart found complete recognition for his talents in Prague. Daniel E. Freeman is an American musicologist, pianist, and music editor who lives in Minneapolis. He has taught music history at the University of Illinois, the University of Southern California, and the University of Minnesota. And since 2002, he has appeared regularly as a speaker at the Smithsonian Institution. All of this and more. So stay tuned to Right On Radio. And now, this.
Daniel, welcome. So I want to quote from your book. I think it's from your preface. It's very hard to balance the expectations of music lovers and musicologists simultaneously.
Indeed.
Some readers may decide to skip over and the discussion of musical works or other parts if they are not of particular interest in order to concentrate on the portions that satisfy the greatest personal curiosity. So I wanted to say that as coming from your background of academia, there's a certain way of discussing music and writing about music. It's clear to me that you have taken the path of trying to instill your writing with the love of the music, but love of also the interrelationships between people.
Absolutely.
And that's what one of the things I've found most interesting is the way you've laid out the relationships and how that caused Mozart to end up visiting Prague.
Indeed. Which are fascinating. It's amazing the people that he knew, how he came into contact with him, how many people loved him so much. So amazed at his talents.
He was a great networker, wasn't he?
Indeed he was. He was naturally social.
Yes.
He loved company.
Yes, he did. But I think he also loved the exchange of views with people who were thinking about art, about the challenges of making art, but also people who cared about quality. I think he was always finding the connections on that level.
Yes, and he was accustomed to being around such people from the time he was a child.
Yes, his father set a very high standard for him.
Yes.
And but I think also the other thing that I noticed is the role that, so your book is called Mozart in Prague, and it's basically about the experience Mozart had visiting and being inspired by Prague to create some significant works in his repertoire, but also the experience he had of being totally loved.
Yes.
And he always struggled with being appreciated in his lifetime.
Yes, that's true.
And Salzburg was a challenge for him.
Indeed.
And Vienna, particularly, was filled with vipers and people who were jealous of his talent.
Yes, vicious rivals.
Yes, vicious rivals.
Bitter rivals.
Yes, indeed. So it's clear to me that in Prague, it's an environment and a cultural environment which was unique.
Yes, it was.
Could you say a little bit about what you write about, the musical qualities, the cultural qualities? And I think what's interesting, in the first part of the book, you give it a historical context, mm-hmm. how it became the way it was by the time Mozart visited. Could you say a little bit about that?
Yes. The basic thing that was going on in Prague at the time of Mozart's visits is that it was a recovering city. It had been greatly depopulated in the 17th century, the 1600s, mm-hmm. due to warfare. Mm-hmm. And it took over a century for it to recover its population and also its cultural institutions, which was mainly a phenomenon sponsored by the nobility of the Kingdom of Bohemia, of which Prague was capital, who were greatly enriched by the institution of serfdom. So they were vastly wealthy, and they did use a lot of their wealth to help build up the cultural institutions of Prague.
Of course, that's a touchy subject these days.
Indeed it is.
And one which you actually rather very boldly, you just go straight to there. You say,
yes.
this is a problem, that a lot of this culture, this money came from something that people didn't really want to talk about.
Yes.
The fact that they had these privileges, and then they were challenged, weren't they? They were challenged by mostly Joseph.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And the income from all this free labor, basically.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And Joseph threatened that because he wanted to eliminate the privileges. His goal was to do it entirely, to entirely eliminate serfdom. He did succeed, while he was still emperor, to free a very large proportion of the serfs in Bohemia, but his brother Leopold sent them back into servitude.
That's right.
Yeah. Within a year or two.
So this problem was not talked about publicly as much, because they were embarrassed about it.
Indeed.
And they wanted to keep their privileges, so why would they talk about it? It was, they would complain about this, that, and the other, and describe the culture and the relationships between the classes, but that was a sort of no-go area, wasn't it?
Indeed it was. And I do have extensive quotations from a noble who was reminiscing about those times, and he was very gingerly about
how
he brought
that
up serfdom. Yeah. It was all implied. You had to know what he was really talking about,
mm-hmm.
because he didn't want to admit what his social class was up to and the true negative implications of it.
Yeah, so this is the dark side of the culture that that Mozart was coming into. But Mozart was the class that he mostly dealt with in terms of his commissions, in terms of the people who were interested in his work. They were sponsors of his. They were
and
you could say these ill-gotten gains made the money that paid for these commissions. And
that is true. And as I say, that's one of the dirty secrets of 18th century musical patronage that musicologists hardly ever talk about, almost never.
I think that's one of the most notable things I noticed quite early on with what you were discussing. So this sort of balance between musicology and your writing for the music lover, I think what you decided to do was give an academic context for this experience. And one of the things you do is quote extensively from people who wrote about their experiences. So these are personal observations of lived experience, whether it's, you know, meeting Mozart, going to a concert of Mozart, or what it was like to live in Prague at this time and the experiences. So that part is the sort of a nod to academia, in the sense I'm quoting my sources, and I found that very interesting. But you do use that quite extensively in
the
book.
Yes, and there was an amazing coincidence, because it was just about the time of Mozart's visits that were all sorts of guidebooks to the city appeared in the German language. And they're very interesting what it said about life was like in the city. And during the period of the Emperor Joseph's rule, there was a great relaxation in censorship.
That's right.
So it is amazing the topics that come up, including sexual culture.
Mm-hmm. Ah, how interesting. That revolution in Austrian society because of Joseph's relaxation is something that fascinated me greatly in the 80s, the 1780s.
Yes, the 1780s.
It was an incredible change. And he kind of let the cat out of the bag, or he sort of opened the doors, and they never quite shut. Even though when his brother came into power,
Leopold,
yes. And then after that, they became a repressive society.
Indeed.
And they banned secret societies. They banned the sort of publication of things which were deemed
subversive.
Yes, that's right. Because yes. I think everything about Joseph. He's a complicated character because he was an idealist. He was an idealist, and he really wanted to change the world, but he wanted to do it all at once.
All at once, and his way.
His way.
He was not a Democrat.
No, he was an autocrat.
He was an autocrat.
But it was well-intentioned.
Yes, it was well-intentioned, but he didn't know how to do it right.
And then once he got into trouble, he decided to completely back off.
Yes.
And I think people need to know that I think one of the things that spooked him particularly was the beheading of his sister, Marie Antoinette. You know, when you let the spirit out and the revolution comes, it can be very, very dangerous.
Yes. It's Pandora's box.
It's exactly right. And so but you know, it was so interesting for me studying Mozart's interest in these matters, because he was a thinker. I mean, people think of it, you know, it's inevitable to refer to the movie Amadeus and the sort of popular idea that Mozart was a silly boy. Brilliant, genius, but a silly boy. And I've always felt that he's much more serious than that.
As I say in the book, Mozart as Peter Pan was part of him. That was an aspect of his personality. The boy who never grew up, it's an aspect, but not central or defining, certainly not.
No, absolutely. And so what happened is he became very interested in serious things. He was a very devout religious person, but
yes.
He also got involved with Freemasonry, which had... two aspects in Vienna particularly that interested him. One was the scientific knowledge base, the new idea of looking, the rationalism come out of the Enlightenment, and then the completely opposite side of the esoteric, mystical side, which drew from sources from the East and so forth.
Ah, yes.
And he had both of those influences in his life. And Joseph encouraged that. A lot of his ministers, his government, were from that organization. But as soon as he turned against it, they all went running, except Mozart.
Yes.
Mozart actually, just before he died, even though it was almost... forbidden, attended a meeting. And he was still a member right to the very end of his life. In fact, the last work he ever wrote was a Masonic work.
Yes, that's right.
So he was interested in deep matters. And so I think the piece that I find so inspiring and what you write about is the effect that somebody being enthusiastic about his work had on him.
Yes.
I think that inspired him.
Yes, he wasn't accustomed to that.
No.
No, he wasn't accustomed to the adulation everywhere that he was able to experience in Prague. It is quite heartening to read about because of all of his frustrations in Vienna.
Yeah, there's another quote in the book which I want to... want to quote from. In many of these quotes, they're basically you're either quoting from a newspaper or a correspondence or something
that's
like
right.
that.
Some type of journalist.
So it's mm-hmm. It's something that it's tangible, but this is about a concert. Ah. When he first was there, I think this was the one when he. Kind of thing here.
Is that the concert when the Prague Symphony was first performed?
That's right.
On January 15th, 1787.
That's right. And he says, in response to a general demand, he gave a grand musical concert on the piano at the Opera House. And apparently, you point this out, that piano concerts were not that common.
Oh, no.
Because the piano was not a very loud instrument.
That's right.
And
it was mainly for playing for yourself or a few friends. That's
it was
what
a very
pianos
intimate,
were for.
Intimate mm-hmm. thing. Never had the theater been so full of people as on this occasion. That must have been inspiring. Never had there been such strong, unanimous enthusiasm as that awakened by his divine playing. We did not, in fact, know what to admire most, whether the extraordinary composition or the extraordinary playing. Both together, they made such an overwhelming impression on our souls that it was as if we had been bewitched. But this mood dissolved when Mozart, at the end of the concert, improvised alone at the piano for more than half an hour, and our delight reached the highest level in loud, overflowing applause. And indeed, his improvisations exceeded anything that could be imagined in the way of piano playing, as the highest degree of the composer's art was joined with the highest skill in playing. Certainly, just as this concert was something quite unique for the people of Prague, so Mozart counted this day as one of the happiest of his life. The symphonies he composed for this occasion are true masterpieces of instrumental composition, full of surprising turns and exhibiting a brisk, fiery momentum, so that the soul is carried to a state of exaltation. This applies particularly to the great symphony in D major, the Prague Symphony, which is still a favorite of the Prague public, even though it might well have been heard 100 times. The opera director Bondini commissioned Mozart to compose a new opera for the Prague stage for the following winter, which he gladly undertook to do because he had experienced how much the Bohemians valued his music and how well they executed it. He often mentioned this to his acquaintances in Prague. He was always glad to visit Prague, where he found a sympathetic public and true friends who carried him, so to speak, on their hands. He thanked the opera orchestra obligingly in a letter to Herr Strobach, the director at the time, and attributed the greater part of the positive reception his music had received in Prague to their excellent execution. This trait in his character, insignificant though it may seem, is very lovely. It shows that pride, conceit, or ingratitude were not faults of his, as is so often the case with much lesser virtuosos. So I think that's really worth quoting. That's a part of your book where you're not afraid to use other well-written source material to make your point.
Never. Anything well-written should from the time should be transcribed and translated.
Do you think that comes from your academic training?
Yes, no question. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, quoting your sources and.
Yes, it's all about getting to the bottom of things, uh-huh. yes, and fact-checking, which is so important for what music scholars do.
Sure, I think though. The point I'm trying to uncover here is what caused you to be inspired by Prague as opposed to all of his other experiences, travels to Italy, for instance, or his experience in Vienna, and for instance, in Italy, he was inspired by the singing of the Italians and the counterpoint of Padre Martini, and all these famous people who would inspire him, and then he would go to that seems to me more of a technical side of things, but there's that elusive quality of inspiration. And I think Prague, because of its enthusiasm and their love, and the other point that you make is that they were intensely musical people. And that was not by accident.
Oh, no.
It seemed to me they made a conscious choice to educate the populace, not just the wealthy, but
all the populace
were trained in music.
Including the females.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So everybody was a connoisseur, in a sense.
Yes. Everyone had musical training since they were children. The original reason for it was to have them participate in congregational singing.
That's right. So there was a religious kind of
that was the motivation for starting the system. But as we know, if you get people started on music, many people are going to take it to far greater lengths than was anticipated at first.
Sure. Absolutely.
And that's what happened in the country.
But it made for a musical culture.
Yes.
That was... could appreciate the subtleties and the nuances.
Yes, because they were taught what we would now consider to be basic music theory. Mm-hmm. They were musically literate in that they all could all read notes.
Mm-hmm.
The famously musical Neapolitans, for example, the ordinary citizens of Naples could not read notes.
No.
They would learn everything by rote, and it was amazing by ear.
Mm-hmm.
But no, they were taught how to read music,
and that was unique to Prague and the Czech people.
It was unique to the Kingdom of Bohemia, yes. And music educators are still fascinated by it. There was nothing else like it.
So has this been written about much?
In music, the field of music education.
Yes,
it has, because they're fascinating.
But in terms of a general book about Mozart or in terms of musical culture, this seemed to me something that I found fascinating to come across in your writing.
Oh, thank you. I am certainly not the only person who's talked about it in print. That's true. But I'm delighted to be able to publicize it.
Yeah, I mean, to me that means that it creates a context or an environment for receiving something with more enthusiasm than somebody who just says, "Oh, that's nice, that sounds good." But you know, there's a sense in which you can really take in all the meaning of something.
Exactly.
It's like someone who is literate and has well read. When they read something, they have the sense of the deeper meaning of it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think. If you know, so Mozart, if he knew that his audience, his listeners, would understand what he's doing,
mm-hmm.
he could write a certain way and it wouldn't be wasted.
Exactly. And that's the phenomenon that we see with the Prague Symphony and the opera Don Giovanni.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The Prague Symphony was likely the most difficult symphony to play that had ever been written up to that time.
Mm-hmm.
And Don Giovanni was probably also the most difficult opera to perform that had been written up to that mm-hmm. time. And I theorize, nobody comments about it, but I theorize just what you say. He knew that he was writing for people who could understand what he was up to and appreciate all the subtleties and complications.
Yeah. In my reading about Mozart, it has been... very evident that he was proud of the fact that he could write music for connoisseurs and the general public.
Yes.
And that he could, in a sense, what you wrote about your book, you know, simultaneously, you know, for music lovers and musicologists. In other words, people who know and people who love music. Mm-hmm. I think he was also... He was a thoughtful composer, but he also was a passionate composer.
If there ever was one.
If there ever was one, yes. Exactly. And he found his ideal reception in Prague.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Because of the combination of the love of music and the extra appreciation that was available due to enhanced training.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And there's a very interesting illustration of this, the importance of this, that is concerned with the opera Marriage of Figaro. It was a fantastic success in Prague, and that's what was the immediate reason for his invitation there. But it was only a moderate, at best, success in Vienna. And in the Vienna newspaper, there was a remark that the people who were connoisseurs, who had the extra knowledge, really adored the Marriage of Figaro in Vienna. But the people who did not have this skill did not like it very much. But in Prague, everyone was a connoisseur. So they loved it.
It speaks to the place of culture in the ability to receive great works of art.
Yes.
And I think one of the challenges that classical music, so-called, has is the label of being snobbish and exclusive
even though it doesn't have to be
absolutely not.
And there have been many periods of music history when it certainly was not.
No, 19th century, mm-hmm. and Romantic era. I think one of the great tragedies is when Romantic music gets played in a very intellectual way.
I couldn't agree more.
Where you have music which has fire in the belly, it's full of burning passion, and yet it sounds very
restrained
and very accurate, because people are trying to get it technically perfect. Just go, and of course there's great challenges in Romantic music, technically speaking, that push the limits of what's possible. And so obviously people are focusing, not falling on their face, and they're trying to get it right. But if you miss the spirit of the music, mm-hmm. but I think that's something which I think developed more as Mozart went on. And I think as he plumbed the depths of the human spirit through his music. It seems to me what you're saying and what I read from your book is that Prague played a role in that development in his life.
I believe it did, because he was able to push things to the limit for Prague, but then he just kept right on doing that once he'd been given the outlet.
Once he'd realized that he didn't have to put the lid on it, he could just go on with that. I find that so very interesting. The other aspect of Prague was was the importance of the building of that theater, the new theater in 1783.
Yes,
which kind of brings up the whole subject of, if you don't have the infrastructure, you don't have the possibility to create something.
Exactly. If that theater had not been built, he probably never would have gone there.
But it gave him an outlet, a place where he could do what he wanted to do really well.
Yes.
The stage, the building, and mm-hmm. what it attracted in terms of talent to that space.
Precisely, including the excellent orchestra that they had
yes.
in Prague.
Yeah.
Many people don't realize that a lot of symphonic music was first performed in opera theaters,
yes.
including most of the symphonies of Beethoven.
Yes, that's right.
So, yes, it was much more than an opera stage. It was mm-hmm. also a place where all kinds of different music was performed.
Well, you know, as a musicologist, that most concerts prior to the 20th century, which became kind of almost staid and very prudish, they would have any number of things. They wouldn't say, oh, this is a symphony concert, this is a song recital, this is a piano concert. Okay. They would have arias and symphony movements. They would just do one movement and then and then they'll come back and do the last movement. And then if people liked it, they repeat it.
Yes, almost like a vaudeville show.
Yeah.
A variety show.
Yeah. Indeed, and then they would have a freak show with Liszt playing, you know, all his sort of flamboyant trills and arpeggios and so forth. And Mozart had that quality too, didn't he? I think he, you know, his improvisations and his performance, I think he had a dashing kind of quality about him, and I think he understood that.
And of course, in those days, playing the piano was not just about refining a standard repertoire of masterpieces. What you were really judged about was how well you could improvise.
That's right.
And he was able to do that better than anyone, obviously, in Europe, mm-hmm. from the time he was a teenager.
Yeah, certainly. He was. And I think for him, it actually skipped the that part of the mind which becomes very literal. When you read music, you're trying to translate something. So there's that one step. So you take the music and you translate it and you play it, whereas improvising is much more visceral, much more emotionally connected. And for him, he was going for an effect, an emotional effect. I mean, we know from writings of Mozart, like, you know, when they talk about... in the abduction of Seraglio, about the, you know, the beating heart and the and I mean, he was trying to express the really deep physical responses to emotional situations as we connect with people. And of course, for him, everything was channeled through the operatic filter, which was the great drama of humankind.
Yes, it was a man of the theater, and all the power, the emotional powers that the theater could muster to move people. The Abduction from the Seraglio, by the way, was one of the first operas performed.
Yeah, it was the first one in the theater.
Performed in that new theater in Prague.
That's right.
And that is what originally established his reputation in the city.
Yeah.
And they started just eating up more and more that was coming from Vienna until they just decided they had to have him come.
Had to have him come. They said, we've got this, the other aspect of that theater, which I find fascinating, is the cosmopolitan, cross-cultural aspect that this theater expressed, because
it was
Prague, including into the last century, was a extremely influenced by Germany.
Oh yes,
and it had a German cultural center, so the Czech language and the Czech culture was kind of side by side, but sort of a little. Pushed off to the side.
It was considered inferior.
Yes.
But it still existed. There still were outlets for it.
Sure.
Absolutely.
So this theater was considered a German theater.
Indeed.
And that's why they liked the German opera that came from the Burgtheater in Vienna.
Yes.
Which was Mozart's attempt to bring some German opera back to the center of the empire.
Well, Joseph's.
Joseph's.
Yes.
Well, but Mozart responded to that.
Yes, exactly.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And I think he was enthusiastic too about that kind of expression of German culture through opera.
Oh, naturally. That was its native language.
Yeah. And then they had some Italian opera. So there was the the snob value of Italian. And then they had some Czech plays,
yes.
But that only lasted about 3 years, as I understand from your book.
Yes, because the government didn't like that so much. They wanted to keep the nationalist Czech element under control.
So there was it a political issue?
Partially.
Yeah.
But they were never completely able to eliminate it. There were always outlets for Czech theater of some type.
Because it was bought by the Estates, which is one of the political bodies in the country.
Yes.
And it became the States Theater, didn't it?
Yes.
And then Italian opera was part of the reason why Figaro and then Don Giovanni of Mozart was the Bondini opera troupe and was an impresario for those Italians.
The irony is, in the German cities, if they really wanted to advertise themselves as being great cultural centers,
they had to do Italian opera.
That's just the way it is. That's hard for us to understand today, these prejudices that they had.
Yeah.
But Italy was the great country of music. If you wanted to advertise yourself as being a connoisseur of the greatest music, you would want to advertise yourself as being a connoisseur of Italian music.
And that's why, of course, we use Italian as the lingua franca of musical in schools. We use Italian Allegro and Vivace and Largo and so forth because this was the language that everybody needed to know if they were going to be a musician.
Indeed. Similar to the way they use French in dance.
That's right, yeah. Yes. I mean, but even, you know, like the Tsar in Russia wanted an Italian composer to come to his theater.
Yes, and they did not want the very talented people who were from Germany, who learned how to write in Italian style. In Russia, they only wanted the real thing.
The real
Italians. Yes.
Right. So then that went for a while, and then they stopped doing Italian operas in 1806 at that theater.
Mm-hmm.
And then they shifted back to German.
Mm-hmm.
So that must have been the winds of change in the politics and the and the various cultural things that would go back and forth. And then they reintroduced Czech plays and stuff like that.
Yes.
So I like the fact that, you know, this is sort of the balance you were talking about. You know, you're writing about a history. So there's a sort of academic narrative of what happens. But for me, that was actually a very useful thing to find. I've always found in my reading, it's great to have a context to understand when a work of art is being produced. What were the prevailing thoughts and culture at the time? And then the other really fascinating thing is the friendships, connections, and networking that they found that Mozart had from his time in Salzburg, from his time in Vienna, and from his travels all around, whether it's Mannheim, Paris, or whatever.
And London.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And of course, we don't know so much, but in the 18th century, all the noble families, they didn't have just one place of